guide to meditation for the rest of us.
I didn't approach spirituality from a positive viewpoint, and I definitely didn't approach meditation in a positive way either. I thought that was only for, you know, hippies and freaks and weirdos and people who live in a yurt and are really into aromatherapy and ultimate frisbee and use the word namaste unironically. You know, I harbored every possible misconception one can have, or every possible prejudice. But really what changed my mind about meditation was the science that strongly suggests a long list of health benefits from meditation, you know, including lowering your blood pressure, lowering levels of stress hormones, boosting your immune system, and perhaps most tantalizingly, rewiring key parts of your brain.
That's ABC anchorman and meditator Dan Harris. We talk with him about his book, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works. Then, what can the Buddhist approach to trauma teach us?
In the Buddha's first teaching that he gave, he made some kind of pronouncement like, there's a sense of things being hard to face in life. And the work that we have to do, the spiritual work that we have to do, is to acknowledge the suffering that's there. So that was my beginning idea for the book. Oh, let's talk about it as trauma.
That's psychiatrist, meditation practitioner, and author Mark Epstein. We talk with him about his latest book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The Dalai Lama once said, "The purpose of life is to be happy." A lot of us would probably settle for just being less stressed out. The pressures of life seem to multiply relentlessly. Not enough time, too much striving, too little security. When it all gets too much, we can try to self-medicate, but that just exacerbates the problem. Eventually, we buckle under the strain. That's what happened to ABC anchorman and correspondent Dan Harris. In 2004, he had a very public panic attack in front of 5 million people while on Good Morning America. It was a wake-up call that prompted him to look for the reason behind his meltdown and find a way to keep it from happening again. He found those answers in meditation, eventually becoming a Buddhist. But first, he had to overcome his distrust of spirituality and get beyond the hucksters of holiness that populated the first steps of his journey. He's written a wonderful book about that journey and its lessons, part memoir, part how-to. It's called 10% Happier. It's a great read, both funny and informative. Well, Dan Harris, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
The foundational story of this book, even though it took some years to bear fruit, is when you had a panic attack on national TV on Good Morning America in June of 2004. Tell us what happened and why.
I was in the middle of filling in as what's known as the news reader. That's the person who comes on at the top of each hour and reads a series of headlines off of the teleprompter. And I was a couple seconds into my spiel, and I was overtaken by an irresistible bolt of fear. My heart started racing. My palms were sweating. My lungs seized up. I couldn't speak. I couldn't carry on. I had to quit right in the middle and toss it back to the main hosts of the show, who at that time were Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson. Obviously, it was really scary and also very, very embarrassing. There were 5 million people watching, so a pretty bad day. And as a consequence of having a panic attack, I went to a shrink to try to get to the bottom of the issue. And he asked me a series of questions, one of which was, "Do you do drugs?" To which I sheepishly said, "Yeah, I do." He kind of gave me a look that said, "Okay, moron, mystery solved." So there's a little bit of a backstory here, and I'll tell it very quickly, which is that as a young, eager, ambitious correspondent, I had gone off to cover combat zones in the post-9/11 era, frankly, without really thinking much about the psychological consequences. And when I came home, from one long trip in Iraq, I got depressed and did a very dumb thing, which is I self-medicated with recreational drugs, including cocaine and ecstasy. And the doctor on that day in his little office at NYU Medical Center explained to me that my drug use, although it was reasonably sporadic, was enough to artificially boost the level of adrenaline in my brain and prime me to have that panic attack. And sort of in that moment, it really hit me how dumb I was and that I needed to make some changes. And that set me off on a long and windy road that led to something that made me 10% happier.
What I loved about this book, aside from the fact that it was hilarious, I mean, I think it's the first book on meditation that had me in stitches.
Thank you.
Is that it's really a book about meditation for the rest of us, for people who were not starting out by seeking a spiritual tradition. And you went through quite a journey, which you tell in this book. Talk a little bit about where you were coming from in your mindset about spiritual thoughts, activity, philosophy.
Well, I was coming from a very negative, skeptical standpoint. I was raised in the People's Republic of Massachusetts by a pair of secular scientists. I did have a bar mitzvah, but only for the money. And I was just, you know, this was not my cup of tea, spirituality or religion or anything like that. And, you know, and I still am an agnostic, I would say. So I didn't approach spirituality from a positive viewpoint, and I definitely didn't approach meditation in a positive way either. I thought that was only for, you know, hippies and freaks and weirdos and people who live in a yurt and are really into aromatherapy and ultimate frisbee and use the word namaste unironically. You know, I harbored every possible misconception one can have, or every possible prejudice. But really what changed my mind about meditation was the science, that there's been an enormous amount of research that is still really in its infancy, but strongly suggests a long list of health benefits from meditation, you know, including lowering your blood pressure, lowering levels of stress hormones, boosting your immune system, and perhaps most tantalizingly, rewiring key parts of your brain. And so that's really what put me over the edge.
Well, say a little bit more about those scientific benefits. How do they actually work?
Well, it might help to just talk a little bit about what meditation is. Meditation, first of all, it's kind of, I have a friend who likes to say it's a little bit, the word meditation is a little bit like the word sports. It can describe a whole range of activities. When I talk about meditation, I'm talking about something called mindfulness meditation, which is simple and secular, and it has been the focus of much of the research. And it really is super simple. It involves basically three steps. You know, you sit down with your eyes closed and your back reasonably straight. And the second step is to try to bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. You pick a place wherever you feel your breath most prominently, your nose, your chest, your belly, and just try to bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. And then the third step is the biggie. Every time you get lost, which you will a million times, you're going to start thinking about, what am I going to have for lunch? Why did I say that stupid thing to my boss? Why did Dances with Wolves beat Goodfellas for Best Picture in 1991? Whatever. Your mind's going to go nuts. The whole game is just to notice when you've gotten distracted and to start again and again and again. And every time you do that, it's a bicep curl for your brain. And that's what shows up in the brain scans. You are building the muscle of focus. You're also building the muscle of something called mindfulness, which is the ability to see what's happening in your head right now without getting carried away by it. So you're able in those meditation sessions to notice, oh, I've been distracted by worry or planning or self-pity or self-congratulation or whatever, but it's just a thought. I'm going to drop it and go back to the breath. And that is a really powerful skill, because so much of our life, we are yanked around by this malevolent puppeteer, sometimes known as our ego, our inner voice, our inner narrator, that has us eating when we're not hungry, or, you know, losing our temper when it's strategically unwise, or, you know, checking our email in the middle of a conversation with our kids. And in my case, it had me going to war zones without thinking about the consequences, and then getting depressed and being insufficiently self-aware to know it, and then blindly self-medicating with recreational drugs. So I think that just gives you a basic understanding of how this very simple exercise can boost your focus and reduce our emotional reactivity. And that, you know, overall lowers stress, which is the source of so much of what ails us, which is why meditation has been shown to help with everything from irritable bowel syndrome to psoriasis. So I think that kind of covers it. I mean, I could go on and on about this, but I don't want to bore you too much.
No, that's great. A simple thing to do, but a difficult thing to do well.
Well, you don't have to do it well. That's a misconception, because I don't know anybody who does it well, except for, you know, maybe some monks, and if you believe in enlightenment, maybe some people who are achieved various levels of enlightenment. But this is a tough notion for us type A people to wrap our heads around. But you don't have to get good at this. We spend most of our lives as type A people doing things and expecting a certain result. You know, we're going to play a game and we hope to win. Or we're going to work on a project and we hope it'll be great. Meditation is, you got to go in assuming you are just going to fail a million times. And the failing, i.e. noticing that you've become distracted, is actually success. So it's a very counterintuitive activity. But if you can drop the normal kind of ambition that we have and replace it instead with a kind of grit and resilience, then you can get, quote unquote, good at meditation. And I would define somebody who's good at meditation as somebody who just sticks with it.
And your book is really helpful in helping one to do that consistency. If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dan Harris about his book about meditation. It's called 10% Happier. You know, the news business is incredibly high-powered. You've already talked about being a type A personality. I don't know if there are any more driven people than journalists. It's incredibly unpredictable. And you struggled for a long time to reconcile what you call the price of security with the wisdom of insecurity. Could you explain that, deconstruct that for us?
Sure. I was raised by, as I mentioned, a pair of highly ambitious scientists. They're professors at Harvard Med School. Really great parents, but driven. And my father has an expression, which is the price of security is insecurity. In other words, this was a family that venerated worrying, and I took that very much to heart. I believed, and really still believe, that a big chunk of my success comes from constantly plotting and planning and thinking ahead and worrying about things that could go wrong and worrying about, my competitors doing better than me, et cetera, et cetera. But I knew there was a problem, though, because on the one hand, while I would chalk up a big chunk of my success to having a very active inner critic, on the other hand, I knew it was making me unhappy on a lot of levels, and I knew it was making me do dumb things, and I knew it was making me not so fun to live with, by which I'm referring to my wife, who had to put up with me being stressed and unpleasant. But I didn't know what to do about it. So if you take on the one hand this mantra of the price of security is insecurity, on the other hand, what the Buddhists offer up is an expression from Alan Watts, the wisdom of insecurity, meaning the ability to know that we live in a universe characterized by entropy and impermanence, where nothing lasts and we are not in control of much, and therefore the trick is to let go. This is the Buddhist idea, but taken at face value, it seems like a recipe for passivity. But it's also hard to argue with, because the basic facts of the situation, impermanence and chaos, are hard to argue with. I mean, they're pretty obvious. So I spent a lot of the time in the book trying to reconcile these two seemingly competing ideas. And with the help of people who are much smarter than me, was able to do so finally. And I think in two ways. One, I was counseled by this guy who's now my meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, that worrying, yes, does make sense on many, many levels, but perhaps on the 17th time that you are running through all the horrible ramifications of, say, missing your flight, perhaps in that moment you might ask yourself, is this useful? And to me, is this a simple, maybe deceptively simple, corrective to the veneration of worry that I had been raised with, which is, yeah, it makes sense to worry, but at some point you've reached the point of diminishing returns. And so just asking myself, and this is where mindfulness, having a clear lens on your own internal life, is helpful. Just asking myself, on the 17th time that I'm worrying about all the bad things are going to happen if one of my internal competitors here at ABC News gets a job or an assignment that I wanted, maybe at some point I've crossed the line between what I call constructive anguish and useless rumination. So So that's one answer. And the other answer is, in terms of squaring these two ideas, is another Buddhist notion of non-attachment to results. In other words, don't get too attached to the results. We trick ourselves, we fool ourselves into thinking we can control outcomes, but in fact, we can't. And you know, a much healthier, more honest way to operate, and one that does lead to greater suppleness and resilience, is to try as hard as you can to control the variables that you can control, to work as hard as you can, but then to recognize that the universe is in control or whatever. That sounds a little woo-woo, but you know what I mean. And to let things play out, and then if they don't go your way, try again. So those two, the idea of asking myself, is this useful, and trying to embrace the notion of non-attachment to results, has been kind of the way I've squared these those competing ideas of the price of security and the wisdom of insecurity.
And how's that worked for you in your career, in your job? Do you feel like it's made you more effective, less effective, no change at all?
Oh, I would say more effective for sure, but you know, there's a reason why I called the book 10% Happier. I'm not advertising a silver bullet here. And I think for too long in the realm of self-help or books about happiness, too often we've been peddled these cure-alls that the only people I know who've had all their problems solved through a self-help book are people who write them because they get rich. So I'm trying to sort of counter-program against that. So, you know, if my wife was on the phone right now, she would give you her 90% still a moron speech. So I am not claiming infallibility, but I do think for sure it's made me more effective, because there's an old expression, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it's hard to open a jar when all the muscles in your arm are tight. So it's hard to be effective if you're just a coiled spring all the time. So I think a strategic loosening up has made me more effective on the job. It's also made me easier to be around, and which has, you know, made my relationships with my colleagues much more positive, which, of course, has a lot of knock-on effects in terms of effectiveness and success. So, yeah, I think it's made me more effective, but I wouldn't say I'm, you know, the king of the world or anything like that.
10% happier seems to me fairly modest as a claim. I am a meditator also, although I've had a problem with consistency, and your book has helped me with that because I realized you can do it in smaller chunks. But there was a time when I was meditating twice a day for 30 minutes at a time, and I got so blissed out that I got worried. It scared me.
I don't find that it blisses me out, but everybody, you know, it has a different effect on everybody. But I think that if it makes you, I don't think there's anything wrong with bliss, but I do think there's something wrong with complacency. And I think the two are often conflated. People think that if they get too happy, they're going to become ineffective. But actually, what they really mean is that they think if they get too happy, they're going to become complacent. And so I think happiness and complacency are not the same thing. You can be really, really happy and yet vigilant, self-aware, and careful. You can be really, really happy and still be ambitious. Or it's possible that you're going to become super blissed out and you're not going to be ambitious anymore. But maybe that's an interesting notion. Maybe you'll be ambitious in different ways. Maybe you'll not want to make a ton of money, but instead you'll want to be a really ambitious volunteer worker. It's hard for me to criticize that. But the other thing you mentioned is your problem with consistency, and I'm glad to hear the book helped with that. But I would say to anybody who's listening and has had a similar problem that what has worked for me on the consistency front is to think of it like an accordion. So it's nice to have a goal. My goal is to do 35 minutes a day. Don't ask me how I got to that figure. I just did. But so that's my goal. Every day I plan to do 35. And most days I do get there. But some days are crazy. You know, I'm traveling, I'm working really hard, we have a new baby at home, and so it just doesn't happen. But I always do something, even if it's as little as 5 to 10 minutes, or even 2 minutes. And so having that ability to accordion takes a lot of the heaviness out of the equation. And so I know that I'll get something done every day. And I think, to me, the power of the practice is derived from its dailiness rather than doing one 75-minute sit once a week. Because I think it's the daily collision with the voice in your head that helps you rebuff its terrible suggestions, which is basically its job.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Dan Harris about his terrific book about meditation. It's called 10% Happier. One of the most interesting aspects of this book is really the journey that you take Peter Jennings assigned you the religion beat, something that originally you didn't really think you wanted to do. But that's what put you in touch with folks like Eckhart Tolle and Deepak Chopra. You actually call this part of the spectrum of the of a kind of enlightenment subculture, you call it a parade of unctuous and unqualified preaching to the desperate and often destitute. My question has to do with, you know, how do people work through this stuff? I think that it is the issue. So many people just get totally taken over, and then the rest of us look upon them and go, you know, that's just too woo-woo for me.
Yeah, I think you have to separate meditation and mindfulness out from self-help and all this woo-woo garbage, because this is something that's now been studied extensively in the labs, and it doesn't require you to join a group or pay any exorbitant fees or sit in a funny position necessarily or wear special outfits or believe in anything in particular. It's as I said before, simple, secular, and largely scientifically validated. And there's a reason why it is now being adopted by people who are widely admired and or feared, including the U.S. Army, the U.S. Marines, sports teams like the Seattle Seahawks, who obviously had a bad Super Bowl this year, but they won last year, so they're pretty good, and they made it to the Super Bowl this year. But they have a meditation coach, Novak Djokovic, the tennis player, lots of entertainers like Katy Perry and 50 Cent, the lead singer of Weezer, corporate titans like the founders of Twitter and executives at places like Aetna and General Mills and Ford. So this is not crunchy, feel-good, woo-woo nonsense. This is something for highly effective people who want to be more focused and less yanked around by their emotions. And in my view, it's the next big public health revolution. In the 1940s, if you told somebody you were going running, most likely they would have said, who's chasing you? But then what happened? The scientists swooped in, demonstrated the benefits of physical exercise, and now it's something we all do, and if we don't do, we feel guilty about. And I think that's kind of the trajectory we're on with meditation, and I think that's a really good thing.
But then there's another place you can go even deeper on that, and that's where I had some questions in reading your book about things like the U.S. Army using meditation. I mean, obviously it can be helpful for soldiers who come back with PTSD, but there is something about Buddhism that has to do with compassion, and there's even a tradition is part of the mindfulness tradition called metta, which you talk about in the book. Tell us what metta is, and do you feel there's a little bit of tension between the goal of compassion for all living beings and some of the ways that meditation may be used by people who have anything but compassion in mind?
Well, there's so many things to say about this. You've asked a huge question. I'm trying to figure out the right way to sort of answer it without going down too many rabbit holes. But let me just start with the military. A lot of people in the Buddhist community have raised legitimate concerns about the current mindfulness craze and that it's now being used by people with whom they disagree, including captains of industry and the military. And I respect these criticisms. I do, for real. You know, I consider myself a Buddhist. So I respect those criticisms. I just respectfully disagree. Here's why. I just think more mindfulness is better than less mindfulness. And I think it's okay. It's good for people whose behavior you might not entirely embrace to become more mindful, because I just think that can only have a salutary effect. And specifically when it comes to the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Army, first of all, it's hard for me to argue that we shouldn't have a national defense, and we need people to do that work, and we want them to be, A, as psychologically sound as possible, and B, resistant to the scourge of PTSD, which is, you know, creating all sorts of domestic problems across the country, not to mention suicide. And C, perhaps most importantly, and I think this goes to the heart of the critique, that we want warriors who are not, as sometimes alleged by critics, not better baby killers, but people who kill fewer babies, who are less reactive to provocations from insurgents. Because what's the game of an insurgency? It's to get our troops to overreact, kill people or destroy villages, and turn the local population against us. And so if we can do less of that, it's actually in everybody's best interest. And also, just to clarify, because I'm not sure everybody's aware of this, you know, while the kind of meditation I'm talking about is derived from Buddhism, and yes, I do consider myself a Buddhist, it has been secularized, and that is what is being taught in most places, not Buddhism, but pure mindfulness meditation, which is several decades ago was sort of a protocol was created by a molecular biologist from MIT by the name of Jon Kabat-Zinn, who I think actually may go down as a historic figure, who had a very smart idea, which was to strip all the metaphysics out of meditation to identify that mindfulness is an innate human capacity that the Buddhists happen to have described well, but is not a Buddhist thing, and to teach it in a secular context so that anybody could use it. And that is what is being used in corporations and in the military, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I don't have a problem calling myself a Buddhist because even though I'm an agnostic, because Buddhism doesn't have a god in it. And to the extent that the Buddha made any metaphysical claims like karma or reincarnation, he said, take it or leave it. And I personally don't take it. I leave it. Buddhism was best summed up by a writer named Stephen Batchelor, who wrote a brilliant book called Buddhism Without Beliefs. He said, Buddhism is not something to believe in. It's something to do. And that is the way I approach it, as sort of an exercise regime for the mind that builds your capacity for mindfulness and compassion. And so finally, let me get to compassion. One of the critiques that I actually think is the most spot on from those who are uncomfortable with the current popular embrace of mindfulness is that it downplays one of the central tenets of Buddhism, one of the things that's been lost, they allege, in the secularization of Buddhist meditation, is that compassion is not as emphasized. And I think that may be true. And what I'd like to do is to do for compassion what has been done for mindfulness. Why has mindfulness taken off? Because it's been positioned as something that appeals to our self-interest. The same can be done for compassion. One does not need to be a moral scold. One does not have to be to tell everybody they need to be like Mother Teresa, which we all, I think, feel instinctually is very difficult. Instead, you can do what the Dalai Lama has done, which is to say that there's a selfish case for compassion, which is that when we are focused on people other than ourselves, we tend to be less miserable. And there's science that backs this up, that those who are more compassionate are more successful, healthier, and more popular. And in fact, there's a kind of meditation called metta, M-E-T-T-A, or loving-kindness or compassion meditation, in which you visualize a series of people and send them good vibes. It kind of feels a little bit like Valentine's Day with a machete to your throat. It's a little hokey and annoying at first, but it's been shown in the labs to have a whole wide range of health effects and to actually make people nicer. Preschoolers who were taught compassion meditation were more likely to give their stickers away to other preschoolers they didn't know. Grown-ups who are taught this kind of meditation use the word I less, laugh more, and socialize more. So I think there's a lot to be said for compassion, and I hope that it becomes the next buzz phrase.
Well, that's a great explanation, even with the machete to your throat. Well, Dan Harris, it's really a wonderful book. It's a terrific read, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works, a true story. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
ABC correspondent and anchor Dan Harris. You can read an excerpt from 10% Happier by going to writersvoice.net. You can also check out a video of his 2004 meltdown on Good Morning America. Next up, Mark Epstein on the Buddhist approach to trauma. Stay tuned after the break.
The beast in me is caged by frail and fragile bars, restless by day and by night, rants and rages at the stars. God help the beast in me. Beast in me has had to learn to live with pain and how to shelter from the rain.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about meditation and Buddhism today. In our first segment, we talked with ABC's Dan Harris about how he became a meditator. One of his best teachers, he says, is Mark Epstein, a long-term writer about and practitioner of Buddhist meditation in the mindfulness or vipassana tradition. Epstein is also a psychiatrist who uses a Buddhist approach in his practice. His previous books include Thoughts Without a Thinker and Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart. His latest book is an exploration of how Buddhism can help us deal with trauma, starting with a discussion of the Buddha's own trauma, the loss of his mother when he was just a newborn infant. It's called The Trauma of Everyday Life and is published by Penguin. Well, Mark Epstein, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You're a psychiatrist, and Buddhism is seen as a religion by some people, but by other people it's seen as a kind of therapeutic philosophy. I wonder, how did you come at it? Via the sense of religion or as a therapy?
Well, I always think of Buddhism as the most psychological of the world's religions and the most spiritual of the world's psychologies. But I came at it, I was a student in college when I first discovered Buddhism. I took an introduction to world religion class, and the Buddhism part popped out at me, spoke to me. And I pursued that for 5-6 years probably before I decided to go to medical school with the notion of becoming a psychiatrist. So for me, the Buddhism really came first. But I think the psychological dimension of it spoke to me.
So this is the most spiritual of psychologies. How does the spiritual dimension inform or improve the therapeutic relationship?
I don't know if it does anything for the therapeutic relationship. I think the therapeutic relationship is spiritual in its own right, or can be spiritual in its own right. But I think maybe Buddhism gives permission to think about it that way. If you read the history of psychoanalysis, the psychoanalysts themselves were sensing what we might call the spiritual dimension of their work in a time when spirituality wasn't really talked about very much or wasn't very much in fashion. But they kept edging into that territory themselves. And then I think when Buddhism comes along, it has a different kind of language. So it lets us look at the therapeutic relationship, but maybe with an eye to more of what's going on nonverbally instead of just thinking about it as the talking cure.
This book in particular talks about the trauma of everyday life. Trauma is its subject. It seems like a lot of people become involved with Buddhism because they have suffered trauma in their life and they're looking for peace, for inner peace. And you start out the book right away by really going quite beyond the idea of inner peace, to wrestle directly with the idea that trauma is everywhere.
Yeah. Well, I was taking the first truth of the Buddhas, you know, suffering, dukkha. I was taking that as the jumping off place for my book, substituting the word trauma for the Buddha's word dukkha. Dukkha really means hard to face. Dukkha, cause face. So, and there's sukha, which is like sweet to face, and dukkha, difficult to face. So the Buddha's first teaching that he gave, he made some kind of pronouncement like there's a sense of things being hard to face in life. And the work that we have to do, the spiritual work that we have to do, is to acknowledge the suffering that's there. So that was my beginning idea for the book. Oh, let's talk about it as trauma. And then there's a little known fact in the a biography of the Buddha that his mother died when he was just a week old. And I knew that, but I had never really thought about it. And then when I did start to think about it somehow, I thought, oh, look, there's this little hint of suffering right at the beginning of the Buddha's life. And maybe that's there for a reason. You know, maybe it's a kind of stand-in for the psychological, emotional suffering that people carry from early life that we as psychotherapists know about, but that was never really talked about that much except hinted at in this biography of the Buddha. So I was trying to weave all that together in the book.
Yes, you spent a lot of time in the book actually talking about this primary trauma of the Buddha. And I guess the story is that because of his mother's death, his father wanted to protect him henceforth from any kind of suffering. And then he saw suffering, and then something happened to him. For those of our listeners who are not up with the story of the Buddha, just tell us in brief what happened.
Well, my first idea in writing this book was to do a kind of psychobiography of the Buddha, the way Eric Erickson did of Gandhi and Luther. So that element, that thread is in the book. So the Buddha at 29, he's been protected, he's gotten married, his wife has a baby boy, and then he goes out of the palace walls in the myth of the Buddha, in the story of the Buddha. He goes out of the protected environment and he sees an old person and a sick person and a corpse and a wandering mendicant, a wandering spiritual figure. And it's his first confrontation with death. And he goes back home and then he replicates the infantile trauma. He abandons his wife and his newborn son the way that his mother died and left him at a week. He leaves the family and goes off into the forest, which was in those days like going to California or something and studying with some New Age gurus. He goes to the forest, which was the where people went to escape the conventional life. So he goes to seek the spiritual life. And then he's 6 years in the forest until he finds his enlightenment.
Those 6 years in the forest, he's doing some spiritual practices that in a way increase his suffering. I mean, the point is to deny pleasure and increase suffering. And yet Buddhism is really about, in some way, an end to suffering. So how did he get from the self abnegation of the flesh, you know, it's almost like the medieval monks who went around whipping themselves. How did he get from there to enlightenment?
Well, a lot of people think that meditation comes from Buddhism, but that's not true. Meditation was already present in the Buddha's world. He grew up in a world where there were many different kinds of yoga and meditation already. So when he abandoned his family, went into the forest, he found a variety of teachers of different schools of meditation, the way we might, you know, do Iyengar yoga and then transcendental meditation or whatever. His first teachers actually taught him a kind of transcendental meditation that was very pleasurable. And he went, far from his body into very sublime states of meditation. He was very good at it. His teachers offered him a place where that he could take over, he could stay and become majority leader, you know, he could have his own ashram. But he saw that even though he could go to those very high places, when he came down from the meditation, he was still himself. And he still had his same neuroses, his same pains, his same struggles. So he wasn't satisfied with the kind of transcendental meditation that he learned. So then he flipped and he went in the other direction. The other main kind of meditation in his day were these ascetic practices that you're talking about, where the idea was not to go to a high, sublime state, but to try to beat the mind with the mind, and to eradicate any sense of pleasure in order to take the soul to a higher place. And he was also very, very good at those practices and pushed himself, you know, the way an anorectic patient in our day might push themselves. If you've ever worked with anyone with anorexia, you discover that these, you know, totally emaciated individuals are very, very strong. And no matter what you do, you can't get them to even, you know, take a bite of toast, you know. So he had that kind of strength. In the Indian philosophy, they call that strength tapas. So he was developing tapas, which is a kind of inner heat. And he was really just about to die when he had a memory a childhood memory, the only time that a childhood memory figures into the Buddha's story. And he remembered himself as a young boy sitting under a rose apple tree while his father was out plowing in the fields. And he was filled with a sense of joy sitting there under the tree, the sun shining, the wind blowing, the leaves rustling, etc. And he thought to himself, and I think it's like a case of self-analysis almost, he thought to himself, why am I remembering this at this moment when I'm doing these ascetic practices? It's a whole different way of being, this memory that I'm having, you know, a joyful, pleasant feeling. And then he felt, I'm a little scared of this feeling. And then he asked himself, why should I be scared of, you know, such a unthreatening feeling? But it was threatening to him. And then he pushed even into that fear, and he said, actually, I don't have to be afraid of this feeling. It's a naturally arising feeling. It's part of my being. Maybe this feeling is the key to the enlightenment that I'm seeking. Maybe I've been going about this all the wrong way. And at that moment in the story, a young woman appears carrying a bowl of rice porridge or something and offers him some food. He takes the nourishment and then he proceeds. He has a series of dreams, and then he walks to the place where the famous tree is that he sat under when he reached his enlightenment. So that memory, that childhood memory, is thought to be the foundation of what's called the Buddha's middle path, which is the path between sensual indulgence and sensual rejection, rejection of all pleasure. The Buddha was not into rejecting pleasure. He said there's a lot of pleasure in the world. You can use that as an object of meditation. But if you structure your life around pursuing only pleasure, you'll end up with more suffering. So he was after a middle way.
In this book, The Trauma of Everyday Life, Mark Epstein, you talk about realistic view, how people can, in fact, contain and hold their real life. Talk more about realistic view and how, through the practice of meditation, how Buddhism confronts everyday life.
One of the things that the Buddha taught was a method of holding feelings and also holding the mind, so thoughts, memories, all the ingredients of our everyday life. The Buddha taught a way of holding all of that without holding on and without pushing away. That's again where you get the sense of the Buddha's middle way. It's all about balance, and balance is something that we're all capable of, but we don't necessarily come to easily by ourselves. We have to practice it. So the Buddha taught methods of being realistic in dealing with ourselves, not expecting us to be superhuman, but not indulging the most primitive aspects of ourselves. So that's what he meant by realistic view. Be realistic with yourself. Look at yourself clearly, with curiosity, with a kind of acceptance, but don't settle for the worst qualities that you're capable of.
So now, Mark Epstein, your book, The Trauma of Everyday Life, not only talks about trauma, but also about the basic precepts of Buddhism, some of which have puzzled me for a long time. And I'm somebody who practices meditation, but I wouldn't say I'm not like a professional Buddhist by any means. So there's this notion of the no self, of, you know, non-attachment, of letting go. What does it mean not to have a self?
Well, that's an interesting question. We all have selves. So the Buddha's teaching of emptiness was not a teaching of you don't have a self. A friend of mine, Robert Thurman, professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia, he tells a story of his first teacher, who was a Mongolian lama in New Jersey, who ordained Bob as a monk in 1960 or so, trying to help him with this question, saying, it's not that you don't have a self. Of course you have a self. You know, I have a self, you have a self, we all have selves, and your self is real. But the problem with people like you is that you think that you're really real. So it's that extra quality of thinking that you're really real that Buddhism is after. So in order to get a feeling for what the Buddha meant by no self, what one has to do is to find in the privacy of your own mind where you take yourself to be most really real. For instance, when someone who you really care about hurts your feelings, you get a pang inside somewhere of, how could they do that to me? So that feeling of me, is how the self appears most strongly. And in Buddhist meditation, you're always looking for that. Where is that feeling of me? Because if you examine that feeling, which if you see it out of the corner of your eye, it's like, of course, me, that's what's driving me all the time. I don't want anyone to think ill of me, or a sense of shame that you might be carrying, or hurt. But if you, instead of looking at it out of the corner of your eye, if you try to bring your awareness to it more clearly, it becomes interesting, because it's hard to find. What is that feeling of me? And as you look for it, and as you find that it's difficult to actually put your finger on it, there's a sense of freedom that comes, like a kind of humor that comes about all the ways that you take yourself so seriously. And that's what I think, in my experience anyway, that's what Buddhism is good for. It's good for injecting a sense of uncertainty, a sense of humor, a kind of relaxation of the rigidity that many of us accrue around our own hurt feelings.
So is it kind of that you're looking at the me in that moment who feels so hurt, and in the practice of looking at it, you get a little distance and you realize that maybe it's not the only me?
Yeah, that's one way. Sometimes you might get a little distance in the practice of looking at it, or sometimes actually you come very much more close to that feeling. And instead of a thought of me that then you're having to protect, you see that the me that's driving you is really just a feeling in the moment that changes. And in getting closer to what it really is, your attachment to it lessens.
So there you said the magic word, attachment. What is attachment?
Well, there's all different, you can use the word to mean all different kinds of things. In psychotherapy, attachment is a good thing. Attachment is what a baby has to a mother, and when there's not a good enough attachment, then there's all kinds of problems. So attachment in that sense is not what the Buddhists mean when they talk about attachment as a problem. I think a better word from the Buddhist point of view would be reactivity, that it's the emotional, mental reactivity that comes out of a kind of selfish take on the world that Buddhism is into calming down. So when the mind and body are not so reactive, then they're not so attached to maintaining a sense of control all the time over how things are supposed to be. And it's that lessening of the need for control, which is not to say that we don't want to try to shape our worlds. We're all the time needing to do that. But there's a limit to how much any of us are capable of that. And that's where the Buddhist teachings come in handy.
And as we all know and sense, that when you've been through a trauma, your sense of control over your life is really blown. So talk a little bit about how Buddhism and this whole notion of trauma would work with the idea of reactivity.
Well, the thing I learned about trauma in the writing of this book is that the most common response to severe trauma, big trauma, which is, when you're confronted with the potential for death or serious injury in oneself or others who one is close to, and the feelings of terror and shock and so on are so strong as to be virtually unbearable, that the primary defense in those cases is what's called dissociation. So in dissociation, the ego, the self, needs to protect itself. You know, it doesn't want to fragment under the assault of these unbearable feelings. So the protective mechanism of dissociation is one where the unbearable feelings are pushed away. They're like put in a closet, you know, they're banished, put behind a wall, so that the ego does not have to fall apart. So it's a real kind of self-preservation. And that creates a split where the shut away feelings don't go away. They don't disappear because we're not that strong to be able to make them disappear. That's what the Buddha found also. You can't really do that. So they're there lurking, and they then can come up when you're asleep. They come up in your dreams. They come up when you smell a smell that reminds you of the thing that you're trying not to think about. That's the whole notion of post-traumatic stress. So the therapy for trauma in both Western psychoanalytic terms and Eastern Buddhist terms, the way of dealing with that is to create a kind of safety zone, either interpersonally in therapy or within the mind in meditation, so that those little bits of shut away feeling can start to be experienced. Not all at once, because that would be overwhelming, but in the safety of the relationship, either the interpersonal relationship of therapy or the intrapersonal relationship of meditation, you create a safe enough environment that those bits of feeling can begin to be integrated again.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Buddhist writer and psychiatrist Mark Epstein about his newest book, The Trauma of Everyday Life.
I'm not sure it comes out of trauma, but you talk of the case of Sharon Salzberg, who is a meditation teacher, and she was co-founder of the Insight Meditation Center in Barre, Mass. When she experienced kind of this powerful weeping, crying during meditation, but then couldn't really talk about it to her teacher. Now, this isn't exactly dissociation, but in a way, it's opposite. But then she kind of felt she had to dissociate from it in reporting on it with her teacher. Why did you give that example in this book?
I think the thing I like about this story, which I can tell you my version of it, is that it's a lot about shame. And a lot of people who come to see me, it's interesting, they'll come for a long time before they really talk about what the deepest feelings of shame that they're carrying are about. And I think Sharon was doing this meditation retreat with a Burmese teacher who she revered, a very strict Burmese teacher who had some exposure to Westerners, but maybe not a lot, and was teaching in a Burmese style where she had to come to him four times a day and report on what she was experiencing moment to moment in her meditation. And she was, as you say, crying a lot. I don't know if she even knew what she was crying about, but the sadness was coming up and through her. But she was ashamed to tell him directly, you know, because that would have been a sign, you know, she's a woman and not a good meditator, and what's all this crying about? And, you know, so he said, you know, are you sad? And she said, well, there's a little bit of sadness, you know. And he said, are you crying? And she's like, well, maybe a little bit. And then he said to her, which surprised her, when you cry, when you're sad in meditation, when you cry in meditation, you should cry with your whole heart. And that idea, you know, of crying with your whole heart, being at one with your feelings, experiencing them completely, but not hanging on to them. That's the Buddhist slant even there. You know, allowing them to pass through you. The idea in Buddhism is that feelings self-liberate. If you get out of the way enough, you know, and give yourself over to the feelings, but don't hang on to the poor me aspect of them, just experience them purely, they self-liberate. And when Sharon was in the position of being ashamed of what she was actually experiencing, there's no way they were going to self-liberate. They were going to stay attached to her.
Well, Mark Epstein, my final question has to do with Buddhism in the world. I know that in people that I've met who are part of Buddhist communities, there are some who are profoundly involved with trying to deal with injustice in the world, and others who say, you have to accept. Things are the way they are. And I know both traditions are there. I mean, there's the Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh, who, you know, was very involved with bringing the message of peace to the world. How can one reconcile the hopelessness that seems to be the way things are, the reality view, and the Buddhist approach to compassion and confronting injustice?
Well, you know, when the Buddha laid out his Four Noble Truths, the first truth was the truth about suffering. And the fourth truth is the Eightfold Path, you know, the path to the realization of nirvana or enlightenment. Some people see it as the path too. Some people see it as after you've had a taste of nirvana, then what are the guidelines for being in the world? So it's interesting to look at it that way too, because within the Eightfold Path, he talks about realistic view, as you asked me about before. He talks about meditation. The seventh and eighth limbs of the Eightfold Path are concentration and mindfulness. But the whole middle ground of the Eightfold Path is are things like right livelihood, right speech, right effort, right action. You know, they're all about using one's self, how to be useful in the world. Is really what they're about, in an ethical way, in a way that's going to further non-reactivity, in a way that's going to further compassion, in a way that's wise. So there's a lot of encouragement in the original teachings of Buddhism for being active, if that's your way. You know, I found a lot of encouragement within Buddhism for my work as a psychiatrist. You know, if I were a legislator, you know, if I were in government, I'm sure I would find a lot of encouragement in Buddhism for my work in government. I think that that's what's good about it. You know, you can blend it in with whatever you do. So it's not that it has to make everyone into an activist, but I think it can be very encouraging for people whose work is in that domain.
I love the way you framed it as furthering non-reactivity in the world. That's very beautiful. And Mark Epstein, thank you so much for this fascinating conversation. Your wonderful book is The Trauma of Everyday Life. And thanks so much for talking with us here.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Mark Epstein has a private practice as a psychiatrist in New York City and teaches at NYU School of Medicine. He's a contributing editor to Tricycle, the Buddhist Review, and the author of 6 books on Buddhist psychology, including Thoughts Without a Thinker and Going to Pieces Without Falling Apart. You can read an excerpt from The Trauma of Everyday Life by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.